This podcast was made possible by the Heising-Simons Foundation. The Center on Enhancing Early Learning Outcomes at the National Institute for Early Education Research presents Legacy 2030, Pioneers in Early Childhood Education. On this episode, we speak with Sue Bredekamp, Early Childhood Consultant and HiScope Board Emeritus. Sue, what research and experiences influenced your career?
And my field is really child development and learning. And so my sense about early childhood policy and educational policy is that it really needs to be informed by what we know about child development and learning. And so I look at research on practice. I tend to look at research on practice. I used to be very influenced by theories, and certainly over the course of time, some theories have been more influential in my thinking than others. Recently, Vygotsky's theory of scaffolding children's learning has been, you know, very influential in my writing about effective teaching and that kind of thing. But I think, for example, the brain research, I've seen the impact of that kind of research on practice and policy. I think that sort of thing and how it's influenced, you know, when you know what's going on in the first 3 years of life from direct brain research, then policy such as funding early Head Start can lead directly from that. It should lead directly from it more often than it does.
What have been the most notable changes in early childhood education in the past 30 years?
What we now have seen in the intervening decades for me is just incredible. I never imagined in a million years that there would be preschool in public school. So, you know, that's one of the most amazing things, I think, that's a change. The fact that we have public dollars, and that means that there are preschool programs in public schools. I think the public, the research, the knowledge base has just expanded enormously. Again, I never imagined, like I said, I went into the library, couldn't find what to do. There was so little knowledge and particularly practical knowledge about what to do with children based on the theories. You know, we had theoretical things to read, but we didn't have the real practical implications of that, of the research and the theory. The third thing that I think is a major change or, you know, progress, example of progress, is the public awareness of the importance of early education. Again, I never imagined that I would read a report on a survey of families and parents from a bipartisan policy center that would say that parents of all different backgrounds and policymakers of all different backgrounds know that early childhood is important and that early years really matter.
What lessons from the past have been lost or forgotten but need to be relearned?
We're sort of an ahistorical field, and we think a lot of times that we are encountering issues or dilemmas that have never been encountered before. And I really do believe that we need to study our history and learn the lessons from it. One of the things I have learned, having been in the field for a long time, is what I say this often, is that the solution to every problem contains the seeds of a new problem. And that can be very challenging because you think you've solved something and all of a sudden you realize that you've created another problem. And I think my work on developmentally appropriate practice is a good example of it. We were responding to a specific problem, which was that four-year-olds were going into public schools. We were very concerned at the type of educational experiences they would have. We were especially concerned because of what had happened in the kindergartens and how they had become inappropriate. And so we wrote a position statement on it, developmentally appropriate practice. And everybody embraced it. Everybody thought, this is it. This is the solution to the problem. This will fix these public school programs, these early childhood programs. We figured it out. Well, it created a lot of other problems in terms of misinterpretations, misrepresentations, oversimplifications. It's very hard to anticipate what problems or what, you know, what is going to be, what that solution is going to lead to. When we raise teacher qualifications or insist on teacher qualifications or BAs in every classroom, we're going to encounter a real problem, which is diversity. We're going to undermine the diversity of our workforce, which is, we really don't want to do that. So we have to be very careful about considering what the solutions, what problems we're going to generate from the solutions that we propose to the various problems that we are encountering.
What strategies would you recommend policymakers implement over the next 10 years to improve early childhood education?
To think about what policymakers should do over the next 10 years to improve early childhood education, it's a really big question. My overly simplistic answer to it is that we need to increase third-party funding for early childhood programs in order to improve compensation and working conditions for teachers. We want highly qualified teachers. We have a huge knowledge base about the job, what it entails. It requires someone who really knows a lot, who really is a highly knowledgeable and skilled professional. And the expectation of that competence, if you will, at the salaries that we're paying is absurd. We're not going to ever accomplish that. So we have to work at a financing system that will enhance the compensation of the field.
What do you think are the most common misconceptions of developmentally appropriate practice? What are its most promising but unrealized goals or outcomes?
I've worked on developmentally appropriate practice for almost, over 30 years. And of that 30 years, half of that time I've spent writing and speaking about developmentally appropriate practice, and the other half of that time I've spent saying, no, that's not what I meant. It's been seriously misunderstood, and it's been misrepresented, which is, it's a little bit more difficult to respond to misrepresentations than it is to respond to the misinterpretations. One of the main things that has concerned me over the years about developmentally appropriate practice is the oversimplification of it. Somehow people think it's something really simple. And we contributed to that misunderstanding originally because when we wrote it, it literally was written in two columns, appropriate practice versus inappropriate, which was, again, the solution to a problem that became a new problem, that created a new problem. Somehow people thought, if I could just get in the right column, I'll be okay. They embraced that because it was very simple. Unfortunately, we were wrong. It is far from simple. It's very complex, and it is a complex professional decision-making process, which requires a large body of knowledge. And that body of knowledge includes what is known about child development and learning in general, what you learn as a teacher about the individual children in your class, and what you learn about the social and cultural context within which you are teaching. So those three pieces of information, if you want to call it that, all are necessary to consider in your professional decision making. But the important thing for people to understand is the dynamic interaction of those three things.
What are the most potent approaches to ensuring young children, particularly of color, succeed in literacy and math?
I would say right now, in our field, we need to be lifting up mathematics because the research on mathematics shows that children, that math abilities at the end of preschool and going into kindergarten predict not only later math, but they predict literacy. The thing that for me is important about both of those things is that they both depend on language. You know, that literacy and math fundamentally are languages. Math talk is what makes children make progress in their understanding and their conceptualization of quantity and all the other large notions about math that are essential to later understanding when they get to school. Language is essential. The math talk that builds the concepts in mathematics, it's essential for science. You know, there's a vocabulary related to all of these curriculum areas, and children need that academic vocabulary if they're going to make progress in school, in the academic curriculum. And so the more we can introduce or add these vocabulary words to children's experiences that they're having, these engaging learning experiences that hopefully we're providing them in early childhood programs, is we need to add the complex vocabulary to those experiences in order to take those everyday, fun, playful experiences and help them become foundations for which children can build when they get to school and they're more academically connected. So without that connection of the language, it's much more difficult for children to make the links between the everyday experience and the academic curriculum.
What is your proudest accomplishment?
Well, my proudest accomplishments in early childhood were not individual accomplishments. They were my capacity to work with a cast of, I'll say hundreds, but it could have been thousands. I think it really was thousands. To work with a cast of thousands to develop NAYC accreditation against a lot of odds, because there was a lot of opposition at that time about national standards, with state licensing standards being so variant. It's really difficult to come to consensus with all those diverse perspectives. So I'm very proud of that. And under very similar conditions, the work I've done on developmentally appropriate practice. And I'm proud of, again, not as an individual person, because none of that work was done individually. All of that work was done with huge groups of people. And I think that on those two bodies of work, accreditation and developmentally appropriate practice, but particularly the latter, I had to do a lot of learning, a lot of listening. Those documents evolved over time with a lot of input from a lot of people. What I'm excited about now really is the growing research base on practice, on effective practices. Recently, I write a textbook for introductory early childhood teacher education courses. In fact, the book I write is called Effective Practices. I don't talk about developmentally appropriate practices anymore. I talk about effective practices. And we have a lot of research now on that. And I'm especially excited about the research on the kinds of effective practices that promote executive function and that promote self-regulation and that help children with challenging behaviors, children who are coming from stressful backgrounds, toxic stress and trauma. And we know so much more about that than we ever did.
Thank you, Sue. The Center on Enhancing Early Learning Outcomes at the National Institute for Early Education Research would like to thank the Heising Simons Foundation for its support of the Legacy 2030 Pioneers in Early Childhood Education Project. For more information about CELO's Legacy 2030 project, visit our website, celo.org/celo-legacy-2030. Thank you.